Hello, you're listening to They Came From the North, your weekly podcast from Canadians. Don't hold that against us. Wherein we tackle the creative works of a chosen director in what we like to call a director spotlight. Over the next little while, we'll be highlighting the good, the bad, and the ugly as chosen by us, for you, of the chosen director for this evening. With me are, from the East Coast, Mr. John Mercer.
Hello.
From Central Canada, Mr. Gabriel Girard.
Party on, dude.
And from the West, or soon to be Central, I guess, huh?
That's right.
Mr. Andrew Forbes.
Hello.
Tonight, we'll be discussing Sir Ridley Scott. Born 30th of November, 1937, he's an English director. He cut his teeth at the BBC doing originally production design and set construction. He just narrowly missed out on designing Doctor Who's trademark Dalek villain because he was about to direct his first episode, I believe, of Zed Cars. So he passed it on to an accomplice.
Well, he made the right choice.
Shortly thereafter, he did begin a rather successful endeavor in television commercials, directing over 2,000 television commercials before getting the chance to direct his first feature film, The Duelists, on his 40th birthday in 1977. Shortly thereafter, he got Alien, which was riding high on the wave of science fiction brought on by Star Wars. Then Blade Runner, which kind of earned him a name as a strictly science fiction director, something he very quickly eschewed when he did Legend, which was about as far removed from Alien and Blade Runner as you could get. Crazy, off-the-wall, surreal, nightmarish fantasy film. And after that, he settled into some crime dramas, kind of coasted for a while. We saw Someone to Watch Over Me. We had Black Rain. We had... What came after Black Rain? That was Thelma and Louise, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was.
Yep, Thelma and Louise, which really kind of set him back up extremely high. Got him his first nomination for Best Director at the Oscars. Best Picture. It was generally considered, you know, one of the big ones of that era.
It ushered in the 90s.
Yeah, it really was the first big must-see talked-about film of the 1990s. He went a little independent after that. He brought us 1492, which was self-funded. Thereafter, he kind of settled again into just a hired gun role, doing a lot of studio pictures. He had White Squall. He had G.I. Jane, which was a Demi Moore vehicle that raised a little bit of controversy at the time for, you know, its whole theme of women empowerment and that sort of thing. And came back big time in 2000. But we'll get to that on a later episode. For now, we'll cover the first era of Ridley's work. We'll start with The Duelists in 1977, leading up to G.I. Jane. And I will start with Mr. Forbes. What's your good from the early period of Ridley Scott?
There was a lot of hand-wringing over this one because, I mean, obviously it's going to be one of the two, either Alien or Blade Runner. I was just totally torn, but I have to come back to Blade Runner. It's the one that I think it's just got such a, not to take anything away from Alien, but Blade Runner just has such a rich world that it's created. Certainly more expansive than Alien, although Alien I wouldn't say is any less exceptionally well designed, obviously. And it's a movie that I kind of caught when I was really getting into really sort of getting into movies in a big way, sort of beyond just renting one every weekend or two, and starting to study them, and it impact on me. It's just I don't even know what more I can say about Blade Runner. So much has been said about all its various versions. The speculation over whether or not its protagonist is indeed the human he is presented as, or perhaps is a replicant. any number of things about this movie you could go on for some time, and yet it seems that I am having trouble finding anything to say about it. It's just it's amazing.
It's a daunting task, man. I mean, where do you start?
Exactly. I don't know where, and I think that's the problem I'm having.
Well, I think one of the great things about Blade Runner is that it's not it's really the totality of the whole that makes an impact on you. And like the last time I watched it, I wasn't like really in the mood or anything. And like, I really liked it, but I was kind of, it wasn't as good as I remembered. And then like, I thinking about it for like 2 or 3 days after. And I'm like, maybe it's still as good and maybe it's even better than I remembered.
Because you were the first in that situation.
Well, no, I think it's the kind of movie that can work on like on your subconscious, because there's a lot of things that are underplayed or that, you know,
it's an exceptionally dreamlike movie.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because it's set up almost as a sort of 40 style police procedural in a way. But it just sort of glides along on this neon lit, foggy, future noir atmosphere. And it has the flavor that no one has. A ton of movies have been inspired by Blade Runner, which obviously in itself it was inspired by Metropolis in terms of the design of its huge city, but Blade Runner pushed the bar even higher, and a lot of filmmakers of the last 20 years took a lot from it. But nobody has captured the same I guess reality. It's unlike anything you've seen on the screen, but it feels completely realized, completely thought through, and it's just fantastic. And it's also, I think, one of the things that it benefits from a great deal is it really trades in sort of moral ambiguities and emotional ambiguities. So it's not something as nice and tidy as, you know, depending on which cut you see. it doesn't necessarily end with, you know, the good guy triumphing over evil and running off into the sunset with the girl, although it sort of does. In, shall we say, one of the more definitive versions, it's significantly more downbeat and ambiguous of how everything is resolved with Deckard, the protagonist, and it's a movie I could watch any number of times. And I, like Gabe said, I may not always be in the mood, but I'll never be done with Blade Runner. I'll always come back to it.
And I mean, as far as just the pure, you know, world building and the feeling, as far removed as it is stylistically, I think that the only movie that maybe can step up to par is Terry Gilliam's Brazil.
Quite possibly. In terms of making a world that's sort of a fully realized urban environment that's nothing like what feels completely, I guess, plausible isn't necessarily the word. It's not plausible in terms of real world, I think, but there's a certain, I don't know, like they seem prescient in terms of sort of these cities kind of manifest all of the darkness, those sort of less definable, less tangible qualities that people sort of sense about moving into the future. And I mean, in some obvious and some more subtle ways, certainly with Brazil, I mean, you have the whole sense of bureaucracy taking over and any number of other things. But there are cities that seem to be totally, you know, born out of the anxieties of an increasingly urban, increasingly multicultural world, an increasingly corporatized world. And, you know, it's, you know, obviously they're still driving ridiculous flying cars, and there are any number of things that are outdated in a strictly liberal sense, and in, but there are all these things that I keep finding that it gets right in terms of the kind of tenor of the time, or maybe not our time, but sort of the experience of moving into a more unfamiliar future.
I also picked Blade Runner for mine. It was an easy choice. Blade Runner is not only for me. I can't say it's Ridley's like straight up most accessible film, but it is definitely like his most finely crafted film. Like it's something that really like just the care and attention that went into every frame of that film is staggering. And to kind of elaborate,
to say that something is the most well crafted movie of Ridley Scott's filmography, say what you will. I mean, there is no such thing as a poorly crafted Ridley Scott movie. So it really says something.
Yeah, and it shows like to kind of elaborate on what you were saying, Andrew. It shows his attention to detail when it comes to like not necessarily creating a real world, but creating a convincingly real world. Mm-hmm. And it's something that, you know, every one of his films, you can take away what you want from it, but that's one thing that Ridley just freaking excels at, whether it's his older stuff or like more recent stuff with Arthur Max. But like, you know, movies like Gladiator and Robin Hood and Kingdom of Heaven all benefited from being believably real. You know, like, no, they weren't historically accurate movies.
I mean, you certainly have your share of humorless, miserable, you know, period perfectionists and historians or military geeks who, you know, will pick out certain things about his historical movies or his military movies and say, that's not quite right. But he, from what I understand, he's not particularly interested in getting, you know, it's not that he's not detail-oriented and doesn't care. He just knows that it's important to craft his movies so that the average audience will feel completely immersed, if there are some details. Like, I think, for example, Kingdom of Heaven, maybe, you know, the sea towers were a bit fanciful in terms of what would have been used. I don't know. But I know there are some people who that would never happen. But it feels appropriate for the film.
Yeah,
you're willing to go into one of his films and accept that.
He really makes it convincing. Whether it's true or not, it's convincing. It's done in a convincing manner. And I know one of the quotes he always like spits up in interviews whenever he was questioned about Gladiator and stuff like that was, never let the truth get in the way of a good story.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing with Blade Runner in particular is, it follows all of the classic sci-fi tropes. You know, it's not narrative driven. It's not this big action adventure piece like Star Wars or like, you know, Avatar or something like that. It hinges on a very simple plot concept. You know, it's a bunch of guys got into town who weren't supposed to be there. Here's the cop who's hunting them down. You know, and that's like
for sure.
But what makes it so different and so special is, it's one of those films where it, you know, it goes beyond the simple narrative. It has themes and philosophies and all of that sort of thing in place. Like, you know, Deckard as a replicant. Is he a replicant? Is he not? These replicants, these people who are made of living genetic tissue, you know, are they themselves really, you know, just another form of human, or are they an artificial creation? And like, it's all of these deep concepts that that really classic sci-fi is built on. You know, it's not just a straight ahead. It's not just Harrison Ford shooting people for 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's
what I take from Blade Runner in terms of its deeper sort of explorations of humanity, if you want to call it that. You know, like you said, it's dealing in these themes that are really the foundation of a lot of the great sci-fi. They were certainly not new in 1982, and I think it's easy to overpraise Blade Runner in the sense that it doesn't necessarily specifically delve and deconstruct these ideas to a hugely detailed degree, but I don't think it's trying to. What it does is it presents everything with sort of such a mutability that anyone coming to it is able to
use it as a springboard
to consider the issues in a broader sense.
They can interpret it however they want to interpret it, and that's something Ridley does
really
well anyway. Yeah,
it's not an accident.
No, exactly. Like, I mean, in regards to thoughtfulness versus, you know, like, holy crap, I didn't even notice that, and people are kind of making, like, drawing their own interpretations. It's like, no, all the seeds are planted there. All the seeds are thoughtfully left behind, you know? Like, something so simple as having the DP use a mirror to shine light in Harrison Ford's eyes so that he gets the light glare, you know? Like, little hints and stuff like that.
It's almost the, you know, the it's almost like the a brother to the kind of movie like, what was that movie about that super low budget time travel movie?
Primer.
Yeah.
Primer.
Yeah.
But it's sort of like they're both movies that are very interested in these sort of fundamental sci-fi ideas. Primer is meticulously plotted to the point where everything clicks together like clockwork.
Yeah.
Blade Runner, on the other hand, is almost that. I mean, it's akin to that, but it's also sort of the opposite.
Yeah.
It's not taking all the pieces so that eventually it works together as this Swiss watch. What it does is it blends the whole in every aspect of it in terms of the sound, the visuals, the acting, and puts in all of these small eccentric details that sort of allow you to go off on sort of intellectual tangents or emotional tangents. And in a sense, in that way, it's a movie that I find, unlike a lot of movies, you can almost come into it at any point and have sort of a full experience, even if you're not watching the whole movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't want to say it's certainly not episodic, I don't think. But it's almost like it's got such a steady flow that you can kind of just drop in and get carried away with it.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of wherever you come in.
Two more thoughts on it before I shut up about it. But number one thought is the little stuff, all the little character details. I mean, everybody focuses on the production design, but okay, for example, the scene where Deckard shows up at the police station, Gaff has brought Deckard in to see Bryant, and, you know, the three are in the office, and Bryant is carrying on like such a hard ass. He's you know, like, if you're not cop, you're little people, yada, yada, yada. And as soon as Gaff leaves, he is shit-baked. His demeanor changes completely. Stuff like little stuff like that, you know? Like, I mean, evidence. And, some people say, oh, no, Deckard's not a replicant. It's just because he's briefing and he's gone serious. It's like, no, that's because one of these things that these guys hunt and kill is locked in a room with him. And if he knows what he is, he's going to turn on him. You know, like he's going to prevent his own death. This guy is terrifying.
The stuff that's great is that you can read the same scene the other way, that
exactly,
he's a human.
Exactly.
And he just doesn't
really,
like him. Well.
Yeah. It's really a personal film. You know, you can kind of go in and interpret it however you please. And I mean,
and I recall there was a long exchange sort of a couple of years ago between you and Mr. Mancini.
Oh, probably.
And completely opposite reading of the movie. And both of you were just like insistent, pounding the keyboard saying, no, it's more interesting to read it this way.
No, I don't think it was me and Dan, because I think Dan kind of was more along my same line of thought.
Really?
I think so. I can't remember who it was now, but it was an awesome conversation.
I know that I prefer the human reading personally, but hey.
The human reading definitely has a more satisfying, you know, denouement. It's got a more satisfying final act if you know he's human. But then you got to put up, you know.
I find the relationship between Ford and Sean Young to be a bit more interesting if you consider him as a human.
Yeah.
Because there's been a whole bunch of other questions sort of about, you know, what exactly what this relationship means.
It blurs the line a little more, you know, it blurs that humanity machine line a little more too, which I like. However, I also like that, you know, maybe he's attracted to her because she's a kindred spirit. Maybe it's a subconscious thing, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And Gaff.
And also, if he's a machine, that's the very definition of cyberpunk.
Yeah. And that was my other point. That was the other thing I wanted to say. That was just my last little thought on Blade Runner. William Gibson may have, like, defined cyberpunk in terms of narrative, but Ridley Scott defined it in terms of look. And, I mean, there is nothing more, you know, nothing more epitomizes cyberpunk than Blade Runner. Nothing.
What do you think William Gibson was watching when he dreamt up No Romance?
Yeah, really though, right? And yeah. I mean, as much as people,
or even if you want to go back to Burning Chrome, what do you think Gibson was watching when he was writing those magazine articles?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, it, like, cyberpunk begins with Blade Runner.
Yeah, and I love getting back to what we were talking about, the little details and everything. I'm surprised nobody brought this up. There's a ton of focus on eyes in this movie.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Right from the very start, when you get the I could have sworn on one of the DVDs I've actually seen the opening scene is called Eye on the City.
Hmm.
When the,
well, I mean,
the...
it's no mistake that it begins with a huge eye, that it, you know, has a scene,
yeah, but,
that
but
entirely
look,
takes place in a lab that designs eyes. It's
but yeah, but you've got the void. The void conf machine looks into the eyes. You've got constant scenes of people looking into microscopes and, you know, stuff. Look, and I mean, how many characters? I'm pretty sure one of the guys, somebody dies by having his eyeballs pushed into the back of his skull.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
Just so much. There's so much. Even the line, "I've seen things you people wouldn't believe."
There's even Daryl Hannah spray painting
the eyes. Yeah.
Raccoon mask of paint over her. Yeah.
I don't think you're pretentious to and try to read too deep into that, but it's just one of those really the things that just makes Blade Runner stand out, makes it different.
But there's the old saying that the eye is the window into the soul.
Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say, I don't think it would be too clever an observation to suggest that that's probably, you know, one of the major inspirations of the recurring eye imagery. Because the movie is certainly very much sort of, I don't want to say, it's very much concerned with the question of the soul.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Know, where it is, where it comes from. Is it a real thing?
And then there's
can it be genetically designed?
You were saying, Jeff?
I was going to say, you're looking at a movie here from a filmmaker who is the mutant offspring of a classical British education and avid reader of heavy metal magazine, right? Mm-hmm. You're like, I like to point Andrew's getting, you know, like, is a soul something that can be grown in a lab, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, is what separates the replicant from human is... Is it just a collection of experiences? Why are they so, you know, why does Leon collect photographs? Why are they, you know, they're so obsessed with memories and trying to gather up these experiences so they can try to understand, you know, the feelings. They start to build their own emotions.
I was going to go off on a bit of a tangent, because I'm glad, John, you mentioned Heavy Metal Magazine, because if you want to talk about sort of defining the visuals of cyberpunk, it has to be said that there is a lot of Mobius.
Yeah, definitely.
Have you ever seen a Ridley Scott man? He's a huge Mobius fan.
I think there's more Mobius in Alien Mobius than there is in Blade Runner.
You can certainly make the argument that there's more in the other than Blade Runner, but I don't think you can argue that there isn't a ton in Blade Runner. even Ridley's own sort of sketching style, I feel, is kind of like it's totally drawn out of that European comic world.
Oh, definitely.
From everything I've seen from him, his sketches for Alien.
And think what you want of Philip K. Dick, but that old theme about what separates the machine from the man and the replica and all that stuff, that's all over his work.
Yeah.
And in that way...
But what separates a great movie from a crappy, overrated novel is the mood organ.
and like, before we... I think we've pretty much said a lot about Blade Runner, but there's two things that I want to point out. One, Andrew, you compared it to Primer, but the low-budget sci-fi film, I'd really compare it to is more Darren Aronofsky's Spy, which is more about
being greedy and about the soul searching and, you know.
Oh, and I mean, I didn't want to sort of suggest that, that Primer and Blade Runner were too much alike, but they were certainly, they're certainly both very fully realized movies that have a great deal of respect and I guess they call back to classic sci-fi quite a bit.
Mm-hmm.
One more thing for really Blade Runner. It has one of these shots that I still have not figured out. It's one of the most amazing shots I've ever seen. It involves Rachel looking at a photograph of her sitting on a step as a child. And at one point, the photo comes to life. And I don't know how they did that. It's something incredibly subtle, like just shadows from the trees starting to move.
It's a cool trick for sure.
Yeah, for sure. The other thing I wanted to bring up is people always talk about the different cuts, and you often hear people saying, oh, why do people bitch about George Lucas and they say nothing about Ridley Scott recutting Blade Runner all the time? But the thing is, Blade Runner is only recut with stuff that was already there. You know, he doesn't add CGI. It's all stuff that was...
He does add... I believe the unicorn.
Yeah.
No, the unicorn was original footage. The unicorn was original footage.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
That's an urban legend.
Everything I ever read is
original. No, it's an urban. It's a little urban myth that the unicorn was from Legend Outtakes. That's not true. It was originally shot specifically for Blade Runner, and at the time, I can't remember the production designer's name. But he actually even said, you know, at the time he was wondering, what the hell is he thinking? Why is he shooting this? He thought it was the most bizarre thing imaginable. And it was original footage that was shot for Blade Runner. Now, the original, I think it was the 92 director's cut, the one that came out in 92. That one, I think, did use outtake footage from Legend because the footage from Blade Runner was in really poor shape. And at the time, it wasn't a restoration. It was just something that was cut together for a film festival, a 72mm film festival. So they did use, I believe, Legend outtakes for that particular version. But the footage you see in most home video releases of Blade Runner is original footage that was shot for Blade Runner.
Yeah, and it basically just adds stuff or removes stuff or does, like, editing a different way. And, like, there's nothing that's in there that wasn't there, wasn't shot in 80-whatever when he shot it.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And the other side of it, the flip side to that coin, is yes, he is recutting. Yes, he is adding and subtracting or whatever. But we have 5 different versions of the film on one set.
True.
If we want to watch the 82 theatrical cut, we can watch the 82 theatrical cut. That is the biggest difference for me.
That's the version my father-in-law prefers, and he's wrong. By the way, I just say that he's wrong. But
yeah,
but it's so much easier. I do love that it's there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Gaff told me she.
You know,
was
even
different.
Star Wars. No, I mean, there are aspects of the newer versions of Star Wars that add a little bit more punch. They, you know, get rid of some of the rough edges. But I would like the option of going back to the original. So
the Empire Strikes Back style enhancements are great. You know, like just adding backdrops and that sort of stuff. The whole expanded...
We have to stop talking about Star Wars.
The whole expanded freaking Mos Eisley? No. Just no.
We'll do Lucas later.
Yes.
Does anyone have a good that's not Blade Runner?
Yeah, I chose Alien.
Woo!
Woo! Because, I mean, I'm a big horror fan, and I think... Alien is a much more, you know, it's a much more direct movie, accessible movie than Blade Runner, and it was
it's
perfect.
Not a particularly ambitious movie, other than like,
no.
Technically speaking.
No, it's certainly not got the interest in sort of probing the psychological depth of the soul.
But still, I mean, all the characters are very well written. The banter is great fun. The design is amazing. The tension is incredible.
One of the greatest things about Alien, I find, sorry to jump in on you here, Dave, you were introducing your good. to the banter. You mentioned the banter, and one of the great things about Alien is the group cast scenes. When they're all together, it feels like the best of a Howard Hawks movie, with everyone talking over each other, and it just feels incredibly real.
It feels like an episode of They Came from the North.
Very much so.
And I guess that'd make me the android. I'm the one in the background not saying anything.
That was me.
This episode's going to end with Steve kicking down my door and beating me to death in the far end of danger.
Okay, we get Quintus to decide who's John Hurt.
I'm John Hurt.
Okay, you're dead, Steve.
I'm John Hurt, and my chest is leaking.
But
this tastes great, though.
And of course, Alien was pretty much perfect out of the gate, you know, because like he had a lot of problem on Blade Runner, and when it came out, it wasn't like his vision. But Alien was perfect when it came out, you know.
That's the difference with having a producer who's confident. You know, Blade or Alien had Alan Ladd, you know, at Fox, and it had Hill and Giler. So, you know, the guys kind of just let him do his thing.
To be fair, was Alien relatively on budget and schedule as opposed to Blade Runner?
Yeah, this is also true. But again, he was shooting in his home country with a crew he was familiar with, and you know, actors who were all pretty seasoned, other than Weaver, who was, you know, brand new. So he didn't have to put up with any, you know, celebrity ego cram. You know, he was just.
I don't know. Yeah, I can imagine a bit of ego popping up there.
Now, apparently everybody was pretty good at. Now, I mean, there were times they hated him, apparently, but you know.
But and as streamlined and, you know, as you use the word unambitious as it is, I mean, there's still some stuff to pick up every time you watch it, you know, little moments here and there. And that's the Ridley Scott touch.
Yeah, definitely.
It's the world's greatest haunted house movie.
Yep.
Yeah.
It does this amazing thing. I mean, it seems that there are sort of science fiction movies that are too pretty, they're too slickly produced, and they don't feel real. And then there are science fiction movies that have kind of like a grittiness to them. They, you know, they feel good, but they're a little low budget. They're too rough around the edges. And Alien is almost unique, I want to say. I won't say unique, but almost unique in that it is filmed and edited to perfection. It feels completely slick. It has all the power of a major studio behind it. And yet it feels lived in and grimy and raw and natural in all the ways it should.
And the like, when I rewatched it, what I noticed is, you know, like when it begins, it's all those shots of the empty halls and the ship, and it all looks pristine. And as the movie goes on and like it gets worse, like the lights go down and it just grows darker, and like there's beginning to be slime everywhere and stuff.
What I love about it, my favorite thing of Alien is how the beginning, the first act, is such a slow burn. You know, you're 50 minutes into the movie before it really takes off, but it's handled so well. It's like a, you know, it's one of those, you're in a convincing world, you're a voyeur, you know, you're watching this stuff happen. You're sitting there with fully realized characters in a world that is as fully realized as it can be given, you know, 1970s technology, and it just sucks you in so much. It, you know, that 50 minutes flies by.
Yeah.
The thing that's interesting about those 50 minutes is that there's actual conflict and actual relationships between those people, and they're not stock characters at all.
No, you're watching what is essentially a trucking dispute, and it's the most intriguing thing ever because there's a giant spaceship.
And the thing that's interesting is that, like, this drama, this monster that they have on the ship will reveal their true nature to themselves and to, like, the rest of the crew. I mean, when you first see Sigourney, you don't think that she'll survive, like,
10 seconds, you know.
You think she's going to be one of the first?
I wish I could say that, but unfortunately, coming along later as I did, you know, not being Mancini or Hathaway old, I had a bit of that spoiled.
Are you one of those people who saw Aliens first?
No, I'm pretty sure I saw Alien first, but okay. You know, it was legend at that point. You know, it's the Psycho Shower.
I think I saw Alien 3 first for some reason.
Wow.
Oh, you pushed. At least you see Resurrection first.
No. But yeah, I mean, what else is there to say? There's really only a difference. I mean, it's for me, they're probably tied for my favorite Ridley Scott film, both Blade Runner and Alien. I mean, you can't really compare the flicks. They have both goals that they both achieve in a perfect manner.
Yeah, they.
It is a Sophie's Choice scenario.
I'm a huge Blade Runner fan, but I will freely admit that like Alien is one hell of an amazing, like, you know, just a cracker of a movie, man. It's one of those things, you know, that just and it still holds up extremely well. There's no suspension of disbelief involved. There's no, oh well, you know, you got to get past the hokey effects, but it's a pretty good movie. And it Alien is still an excellent flick.
Although there's one shot, and I just cannot understand.
You got to ruin everything.
I can ruin anything. I can't understand why when they're propping, for anyone who hasn't seen it, although we pretty much spoiled it, I don't want to spoil who is the robot, but there's a head.
Yeah, no.
And they cut from the rather fake head. It's just a straight cut to suddenly it's the actor's head alive. And I think it would have been more effective if they'd just done one more cut away to the people sort of wrestling with it and then back to the real. I don't know.
And that's something you kind of, you know, it's.
But that is such a nitpick.
Yeah, that really is nitpicking. And it's just, you know, it's.
All I'm saying, Steve, is that it ruins everything.
Yeah, it's 70s editing. That's all I'm saying. There's not much you can do about it. 70s editing. The movie was such a goddamn product of its time.
and one of the things that has to be mentioned, of course, is Giga's design for the alien, which is just fabulous and so unique, and like nobody had ever seen anything like that before, except people who'd seen Giga's artwork.
Yeah,
even as I appreciate it, as much as I know the history of it, even I cannot. I it's one of those times when you know your own ignorance. Like I know that I can't conceive of how revolutionary that design would have looked on the screen, of how genuinely, literally alien.
Yeah,
know, it
yeah,
looked.
Yeah. Like how just ridiculously haunting.
Mm-hmm.
Like it being sitting in a theater in the summer of '79 and seeing that for the first time, you know, 2 years after Star Wars.
Okay. Point of reference: when I first got the Alien, the Blu-ray set a few months ago. I sat down, actually, Steve, I think it was when you just picked up, we were still watching the documentary on the making of Alien.
Oh, when I declared hatred and loathing for Dan O'Bannon?
Yeah. Well, they had the rather lengthy story of Peter and his artwork.
Yep.
And even after, you know, in 2012, you know, I've seen Giger's artwork. You've had how many copycats and pretenders come along after Alien. I still went home that night and closed my eyes and could see nothing but just writhing shapes in the black. I, you know, 30 years old, and I'm here I am having fucking nightmares after watching a documentary on the making of a horror movie.
And
you see the class.
And in 1979, there was nothing. Aliens in the movies were like the vegetable head from the original thing from another world.
Yeah.
Or, you know, the big tall. It's a cookbook, guys, from the Twilight Zone. Right? Aliens were big, tall actors with funny looking prosthetics on their head.
They were Christopher Lee in 1999.
Yeah.
With a funny wig.
Exactly. Exactly. And here you are. Now you've got this, you know,
insect.
Full on. oily, black-looking rape beast. You know, it's an alien is up. The original Alien is probably sitting on the throne right now for me as the single coolest monster I've ever seen. It's going between the Alien and the Predator, but I do honestly, yeah, I do think the Alien is a little.
The Predator
bit
cooler. can't even come close.
No,
I think.
I mean, as much as the Predator design, you know, was terrifying to me as a child, and I still think it's a really good design. It's, you know, it's still a tall guy with a weird head.
Predator is badass.
I think it doesn't speak to your primal fears as much as the alien design.
Predator is
every bit of Freudian and insectophobic terror.
You did see Aliens first.
What?
You keep calling it an insect.
Because, I mean, it's almost more of a reptile, I think, in the first film.
I don't know. I find it much more insect-like. And I find it more so in Alien than in Aliens.
I know.
I think it's a combination of all things. It's like, you know, some sort of tentacle rape monster, but it's covered in an insectoid exoskeleton.
With slime all over.
Well, yeah, it's like that's coated with like engine grease that's been in, or oil that's been in an engine just a little too long, so it's burnt.
I liken it to just terror personified. You know, it's fear is what it is, and I know.
And what's even worse about it? What there's just that little tiny bit of familiarity to it. It still has that kind of human looking mouth.
Yeah. It's got something that you can
think. All these aspects of things that we're afraid of, and just combined in a strange configuration.
The thing about the first Alien is it does the Jaws strategy so well with not showing the monster a lot,
not overdoing it. Yeah, you only see it in shadow. And I know it's always been a bone of contention. Now I'm not sure if this is. You know, like an official bone or not, but I know a lot of the people I talk to, like a lot of the Aliens fans, like over the years, the guys who prefer the first Alien really don't like how Cameron portrayed him in Aliens as insects. They always find it a little bit degrading to the elegant brutality of the creature in the first movie. And I'm a big fan of Aliens. I love Aliens. I'm not going to say anything negative about Aliens, but yes, I do prefer Alien, and I do kind of see where they're coming from. I do kind of understand their argument, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I mean, when you think about there's not that much difference from the Alien in Aliens and, like, the Alien in Starship Troopers.
Yeah, they're like, just bugs waiting to be stepped on.
Yeah.
I think a lot of, in terms of, you know, the design elements were changed, too. Those were largely practical, I think. You know, they couldn't have this sort of shiny, fragile dome when they're having six guys jump around in these suits. and also, they had to be fit to dancers as opposed to, you know, they couldn't just go out and find, you know, seven foot tall, random, like,
butterflies,
giantly African guys to get in these suits.
Just get Peter Mayhew again.
Were the Harlem Globetrotters still doing anything in 86?
those guys are too beefy, though.
Oh, I said it. Peter Mayhew. That's it. Chewbacca.
Peter Mayhew, yeah.
Yeah, but he's not even what I think of when you say the word
Mayhew
agile.
Looks like Danny DeVito next to the guy who played Alien.
Any final thoughts on Alien?
It's great. Awesome.
How about you, John? What's your good?
I think I just pooped myself. my good. Gabe made a really interesting point when he was talking about Alien, you know, the whole Ridley Scott touch.
Yep.
And, you know, taking, like, a simple haunted house movie and turning it into this wonderfully textured picture that just begs to be studied and looked at and talked about for 30 years. And I just got to get this out of the way. Guys, we've already spoken at length about Blade Runner, and in Ridley's catalog, I would have to say Blade Runner is my absolute favorite. Blade Runner is one of my absolute favorite movies, okay? Blade Runner came out in theaters 3 days after I was born. I am Nexus Generation. All right? I want to pick a more interesting road. And we spoke, see, when we talked about the bio, we spoke about how Dr. Legend really went into a bit of a hired gun phase.
Yep.
And then Gabe was talking about the Ridley Scott touch and, his haunted house movie, and it's turned into this great big spectacle. I went with Black Rain.
Nice.
Now, before we, cause I'm sure Andrew's going to jump in and throw on me for this, but let's consider something. 2 weeks. The governor came onto this movie 2 weeks before it began filming. He was hired on a Michael Douglas produced cop thriller. Okay, so you have a Michael Douglas produced movie. So Douglas has many of his fingers in the pie. Yet the finished product, in my opinion, makes any contemporaries in the genre look just absolutely stock by comparison. Right from the start, you've got the Nick Conklin character, who, despite what is, in my opinion, criminally viewed as a stereotypical Hollywood tough guy cop performance, there are underneath that just layers on layers upon layers of texture and character. You got this cop who, at this point in his career, has already crossed a point from which there's no return. But it's not in his nature to continue down that path. He's not Harvey Keitel. He's not Bad Lieutenant. He's not, Nick's not a fucking cartoon. You could do a movie just about this, just about a cop on his going further down this road of corruption. But Conklin is, he was a hero. If you hear the cops talk early, you have scenes with John Stewart and Andy Garcia, they almost speak of him in quiet reverence of what this guy used to be. They don't think John Stewart is his name John Stewart or
I don't really can't remember very well, John.
Sorry? John Spencer.
Spencer, yeah, John Spencer.
Yeah. But yeah, you got Spencer saying, John Spencer, I'll back you up, Nikki, as long as you're right.
Yeah, I got your back on anything, Nikki, as long as you're right, yeah.
Yeah, and the further the movie goes on, it's because he doesn't really out and say it right at the start, but it's pretty much confirmed he's guilty.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got this guy who's just been crushed and crushed and crushed. He's got, three kids in private school. He doesn't want kids going to school, metal detectors. He's got to alimony. He's paying for his wife's house. He's paying for his own apartment. Like I say, he's $1,000 in the hole every month. He's in the Shylocks. It's pretty much confirmed. Yes, he reached in and he took some money. And at the start, he's fighting and trying to swim upstream, or trying to swim against the current, that anyone would do that in his situation. And then the latter part of the movie really becomes about his redemption. But then on top of that, you got all these other beautiful characters that go. You got the Japanese cop who is
Masahiro Matsumoto.
He's almost. If Nick had gone another way, because Conklin's got this absolute hatred of what he calls the suits. The guys who play the political game, and here you got Masa, who's just been forced down onto his knees in this subservient role by the politics of the Japanese police procedure. And I mean, I guess you can. Some people wrote it off as, it's American tough guy, which is, well-mannered Japanese cop to be American tough guy cop. But there's so much more to it than that.
Oh, definitely.
And you got all this, just all this great stuff. The villain of Black Rain is fucking amazing. Yeah, I believe that was his last role before
he was actually
stomach cancer.
He was dying of bladder cancer when he made Black Rain.
Yeah, and you got this guy who hardly has any lines in the movie in English, but spits so much with just crazy eyes and fucking despicable smile he has.
Here I am, Nick.
Yeah. And he's absolutely amazing. And I mean, with him, you got this, you know, there's another character who's got all this depth just below the surface. Black Rain is still water that runs deep.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got this, the Japanese guy, the Sugo, the other Japanese crime boss says it, you know, when they came out after the atomic bombs went off, the first time it rained, all the ash in the skies, they turned the rain black. Everything that culture stands for has just poisoned this country, and Sato is the result. He's this, you know, he's nothing more than a glorified motorcycle punk.
Mm-hmm.
But he's got like this ruthless ambition and this just thirst for more and more power and money and control, and this guy's destroying the criminal system over there. This, you know, false system, like code of honor that they have over there, and he's got no respect for it whatsoever. He's ripping the entire thing to shreds. And, you know, you could go and say how you've got this, at that point, it's almost like cleaning up a mess 40 years in the making, but then there's personal stuff in there too. Black Rain, to me, it's what should have been a simple, by-the-books, ultimately forgettable police thriller. And it's a movie I've been watching for more than 20 years.
It's infinitely memorable. You know, it's one of those movies that sticks with you.
Yeah.
And I'm not even talking about the freaking absolutely marvelous score. I'm not even talking about the fact that they stuffed Kate Capshaw into another twist that had no... Thank you very much, Ridley. And, you know, it should have been instantly forgettable. It should have been just... Well, another movie like that we could compare it to it that came from that. You know, anything like No Way Out or
Running Scared.
Or Running Scared, Presidio. I keep going back to Presidio because I hate it so much. it's just it's by all means it should have been something like that. And Scott came in as a hired gun, 2 weeks, did one quick run on the screenplay, and it's so textured and visually appealing. I love all the shots of Nixon. I mean, you got the light shining through the fan, and you just keep seeing the shadow of the fan blade pass over his face, or anything as simple as blinds in the background. Ridley was at the point in his career where he kept putting moving shafts of light or smoke and smog there just to have something.
I was going to say, this movie is basically Venetian blinds, the motion picture.
And I mean, I think that comes a lot from a noir influence too.
Yeah,
I mean,
sure.
he wanted to give it that feel. And Steve mentioned the slow burn for Alien, and I mean, Black Rain is very much a slow burn. I mean, the action only really starts when I won't spoil it, but when a major character bites it, like at the mid of the movie.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. In a little way. Yeah.
I love.
I want to jump in here because you know you fairly prefaced this with. I know that Andrew's going to jump in. I don't want to ruin everything, so don't worry. You've made a spectacular case for Black Rain, John. It's a movie. For those of you who don't know, there was a bit of a discussion a little while ago about Black Rain.
There was
not as much of a fan as John, but yes, there's okay. I have to give Black Rain another look. And to, you know, when I was watching it originally, that there was a good deal under the surface. But for me, and this is entirely a subjective criticism, it is the surface tilted for me. It is an exceptionally smart person. Great character in a really obnoxious polyester suit for me. And I don't mean that in terms of the, obviously the visuals are amazing. I find Michael Douglas just, it grates on me. It feels like sort of stereotypical top New York cop posturing that I cannot buy Michael Douglas in.
Well, I
perhaps,
think
but I've never been doing it. I know it had this movie, but it just up the wall the way he acts in this film.
Well,
I like Michael Douglas a lot. You know, I think Wall Street is a severely flawed movie, but Gordon Gekko is a phenomenal performance.
Mm-hmm.
I think The Game is sort of one of the most underrated movies of the 90s, largely because of Michael Douglas' performance. But I just wanted to reach into the TV when I was watching this, grab him by the stubble, and start punching him until he just became a very pink sponge.
See, here's the thing.
Onto the ground.
Gabriel, you go ahead.
I've been trying to budge in. Basically, I think that the character, and that's what you discover throughout the film, is that this guy is like severely emotionally and financially damaged, and he's built up this tough guy persona to help him get through. And like, but to me, he wants to be like, you know, the cool guy, but he isn't, like, really.
But see, to me, the way the film plays it, the way it introduces the character, it's as far as it may go later in the movie, it starts out buying into his image.
Even early on, man, he's got character moments. The scene when they get on the plane with Sato, and he's sitting down with Andy Garcia, and, you know, he's playing solitaire.
That's a little bit in. They're introducing this character, he's like this fucking rad guy in shades whipping a motorcycle race by the bridge.
You see that in the first 2 minutes, and then he takes the money that he won from the motorcycle race and gives it to his son to give to his ex-wife. That's like the second scene of the movie. You know, the first thing you really see.
The troubled cop with an ex-wife who's spending all his money on her fancy house.
Yeah, well, like, I
don't want to say that what you guys are praising in the movie isn't there, but I think you guys do tend to dismiss some very, very stock elements.
But the reason they're stock is because in the 1980s they were real. It was true. This is what was happening, you know? Crime was on the rise. Police marriages were crumbling like crazy because the cops couldn't handle the darkness of the job without bringing it home from work.
Yeah, but it was very much
a product of the time, you know? And you're talking about New York. You're also talking about New York, you know? So, I mean, of course he's not going to be a pleasant person.
Since the mid-70s. That was old in cop movies.
But I almost feel that as if Black Rain is trying to deconstruct that image.
I agree.
What was that?
I said that I feel that Black Rain basically tries to, like, criticize and deconstruct, like, that image. I mean, it wants to see what's under, you know, all that bravura and macho posturing.
But it almost plays it up to the point of satire. Is what I'm saying. Like, if you want to play with that image, you know, play with it. But I almost feel like they turn that character up to 11.
You really got to go back and watch it again, man. You're wrong.
Yeah.
You're wrong. Sorry, dude. You're wrong.
We're three against one here.
You really are.
would you like another order of chess video in a circle?
Yes, please.
No, it's...
My thing, even with what he said about the beginning... And I'm going to go out and say it. To me, there is nothing, absolutely nothing wrong with a movie being just a little tiny bit Hollywood, okay? The opening scene with the motorcycle is entirely there to show you that Nick knows how to ride a motorcycle because it plays into the film's climax.
Yeah.
There is a bike chase right at the end of it, one of the probably 1.5 action sequences that the movie has. There is a short bike chase at the end, but
there are ways to set these things up, and I don't think Black Rain does it well.
Again, I'm sorry, you're wrong. Listen, you're wrong.
what I like about the movie is, you know, it doesn't really play. Like, it gets lumped in with Lethal Weapon or Die Hard or all these other, the big 80s cop action flicks. And it doesn't really play like those movies at all. It almost plays more like, you know, like a crime drama, more like a Michael Mann or that. It has that kind of a tone. And, I mean, no, I'm not comparing it to Heat or Collateral. But it definitely fits more in with those movies or with Pride and Glory or We Own the Night. Like, the hardcore police thrillers kind of thing rather than these big 80s.
With Lethal Weapon.
What's that?
Who would lump this in Elite 11?
It's just in general.
Random people.
I don't know.
Yeah, in general.
Critics in general kind of did.
Yeah, in general, it's considered another 80s cop thriller. This is the problem. And it's not another 80s, you know, cop actioner. It's not, you know, guns a-blazing or anything like this. It is a very different movie. And what I really like about it personally is the human elements. Like the scene on the plane when they're leaving for Japan. And, you know, Douglas is sitting down and he turns over to Andy Garcia and he says, you know, just throws out a name. And but he's like, yeah, what about him? He's a good cop. Yeah, he's a good cop. But that doesn't make what he did right. No, but he's still a good cop. You know, like that kind of thing, right? Like, there's a lot of little human elements there. Like, Douglas is not... I mean...
I love how next to he practically reeks of desperation. His little illusion he's got...
Oh, man, it's
right
cracking.
Thing.
It's
crumbling.
Yeah, it's cracking. And, I mean, like, IAD and all of these other characters are getting to him. They know he's guilty. He's still hiding behind the bravado, but you can see it starting to break. You can see that whole, you know, like... What I did what I did. I don't have to be happy about it, but, you know, I did it because I felt like I had to. I had no other choice, you know? Forced into that situation.
And I don't want to...
The first thing about that character, too, is that, like, he was skimming from the top. I mean, he wasn't, like, getting money. Like, he wasn't
like out taking payouts.
Typical corrupt cop, like, getting his pay cut, you know, his cut every week from
single occurrence.
He grabbed enough. He grabbed enough to make an alimony payment.
Yeah.
But no, it was. I love it. It's great. I haven't even mentioned how the score makes me cry every time I listen to it.
It's an awesome score. It is an awesome. It was actually the first Ridley Scott Hans Zimmer collaboration.
And from the show that Clark Douglas did, he said that it very much set the tone for the rest of 80s action flick as far as scoring goes.
It did. It definitely did. You could see the influence there for sure.
Yeah.
I also got to say, I love the final scene. I love, you know, the big fight and how it ends, and then that last scene of the movie. You know, Michael Douglas is walking off smiling. He feels redeemed. He feels like he's finally done the right thing. He feels like
what's waiting for him at the end.
Yeah, but when he gets back to New York, he's going to be slapped in handcuffs and probably going to go to Paris Island.
The only thing waiting for him is a crucifixion in court in 20 years in the clink.
Yeah.
And, you know, how all those people, like, just start to get up when he brings Sato in.
Yeah, yeah, it was awesome.
Like, it's like a slow clap, but without the clapping.
Yeah. You know, the two disgraced police officers walk in with, you know, the one person in Japan that every cop is looking for. I think that's it for goods, is it?
Yeah.
Let's move on to some bads. I'll start again with Mr. Ford.
Ooh, ooh. Oh, me first, pick me.
Are you sure your throat isn't sore from talking for the last half an hour?
my thirst has been purged by the all the bland brain love I just swallowed. Ew!
Oh, dear.
No, you can go, Andrew. Go on.
All right. Well, my bad, and it's a heck of a bad, is Legend. There is a lot wrong with this movie.
Oh, we can actually double team this one.
It you know, in the context of your last comment, I don't think I want to do that. I'm gonna go first. You can get second.
Keep going.
Floppy though, maybe.
in these seconds.
Let's team up. Legend is one of the greatest looking films ever made. One of the destroyed in editing, hollowest pieces of fantasy fluff that's narratively just annihilated. Whole bunch of production problems came into this. The score was replaced, rightly, I think. There are dwarves doing dwarfy things and weird underground caverns with giant fat ogres and blacksmithy type shops and the most over-the-top Satan that's ever And it's just, it's like you took, if you took the absolutely most idealized form of fantasy paradise and then paired it up with the most black, evil version sort of fantasy darkness, stuck them together and hardly gave any thought to really how they fit, you would have legends.
Oh, you just stole all my thunder. You just all outlined the reasons why it's my ugly.
Yes. Despite that, it is just really beautiful in terms of its design and its cinematography. There are aspects of the design I don't like. I don't particularly Robert Kane's goblin designs.
Those huge horns on Satan
are amazing. I love
them. We will not knock the Lord of Barakas in my house.
It is awful and glorious and everything at once. I couldn't bring myself to call him ugly.
Have you all seen John Carter?
No.
Willem Dafoe's got a great line in his Terrence Tarkus, the whole you are ugly, you are beautiful.
You are beautiful.
Yeah, well, he could have been speaking about Legend.
For sure.
John and Steve, don't you think it's like the nearest thing we might have get to like a live-action Zelda movie? Or is it just
me?
One of the shittier Zeldas, one of the Game Boy Zeldas. Like my feeling on Legend, I'm just going to jump in here for a second, is a mess, of course. But it's a mess from the director of Alien and Blade Runner. And for the most part, outside of what you saw in the theatrical cut, it's crafted same level of visual texturing and panache that his earlier films are hailed for. I mean, I kind of feel after Blade Runner was a colossal flop that, you know, the studio stepped in when he directed it and said, oh, can I see what we can fuck with, how we can fuck with and turn this into an MTV hit. And, you know, yes, I got to agree. As much I love Jerry Gold's score, I'd love to see the director's cut of that. I'd love for Tangerine Dream to go in 40 minutes of music. And, give me the director's cut with their score.
The score is almost great, but he has this stupid thing he does whenever the goblins show up. And it's like, oh, oh, oh.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
Like he just started murdering a goose.
It's a sand person. But, you know, in the hands of a lesser filmmaker, there's so much of Legend that just have ended up looking like so much shit. But in the hands of Scott, it practically glows.
This might be heresy, but I'll take the never-ending story over. Hey.
Good lord.
Yeah, that's just Wolfgang Peterson's
German. That's foolhardy and blind as not looking Black Rain. God. Like, I really find most of the acting in Legend to be, I'm going to say somewhat weak, but you can probably translate it as deplorable. And that's a lot of his
duty. Apparently
the age and inexperience of its stars, right? Tom Cruise was, what, 18 in Legend?
Yeah.
And Nisara
was like 15.
And she wears the most ridiculous, like, dress at, like in the Lord of Darkness realm.
Quite.
It's funny, whenever I watch Game of Thrones and that Stark is on screen, I always think of Nisara in Legend.
That dress made me feel dirty. Made me feel like a pedophile.
Okay. I love Tim Curry's Lord of Darkness. I used to own an action figure of Tim Curry's Lord of Darkness. But he's not really given a whole lot to do in Legend. Like this is a guy, when you look at him, he should be as instantly quotable to movie geeks as the Emperor or Frank Langella's Skeletor or even Roy Batty. But yeah. I'm really struggling to remember any of his lines. The only one that ever really pops in my head is the whole beginning, I am Lord of Darkness.
may as well
be the Necrom.
And that's the thing, it's a exotic character, but simply because of the design and, you know, the fact
and
that
the amount of inky black shadow that Scott has him filmed in, like, I still, at 30 years old, just my heart stops when he steps through the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it works so much better in the director's cut that you don't see him any point in the movie before that.
Yeah.
Right?
Here's the thing with using Tim Curry. You need an awful actor under that makeup. You need someone who has no sense of his own over-the-top emoting.
You need a big, thick slice of ham.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, Tim Curry in most things I just despise because he's awful. He is beyond ham. He is.
Whenever I see Tim Curry, I cannot help but every movie he's in, he's like he's playing the character from Home Alone 2. Right?
Or he's still just playing Frankenfurter.
Oh.
don't even get me started on a Rocky Horror Picture Show. I will make you cry.
I can take him in Clue, but in virtually everything else.
So, so Jen,
I think he's constantly just in the middle of, I don't know, like a facial exercise where he's just trying to stretch every muscle to his limit, while simultaneously, you know, being fascinated by every aspect of the architecture of the room he's in. But he won't change the way his head is facing. He'll just move his eyes. Like he is an unknown pork product.
Well, that's because his entire face is just frozen under plastic. he's like the Michael Keaton bat suit in that regard.
Okay, so needless to say, John, I guess Legend was your bad, was it?
Legend is my bad because just for the sheer beauty of it and the fact that it did get that cult following, and, you know, this is a movie that's got its special edition director's cut DVD, got its Blu-ray release. There is love out there for Legend. It could never be my ugly. I grew up with this movie. I can remember the first time watching it on seeing it come on CBC on television. You know, and being that excited, you know, 8 o'clock tonight from the director of Alien and Blade Runner. The dark fairy tale, right?
Yeah.
And one more thing also, well, you know, before we're too far away from talking about bad actors under heavy makeup, Robert Picardo as Meg Mucklebones.
Oh, that was awesome.
You shut your face.
I've ever seen.
That was awesome. my bad was also Legend.
Hooray.
And it's
now three against Gabe.
Legend, I grew up with Legend. I mean, I grew up with Legend in the same regard that I grew up with Willow. I don't love Legend as much as I love Willow, but I was a big fantasy geek in the 1980s. I read a lot of fantasy novels, you know, whatever. But Legend was one of the few, like, quality-looking fantasy movies out there. You know, you really didn't have a whole lot to choose from. You basically...
excuse me, it's no Deathstalker.
Yeah, okay, anyway, shut up.
The only Labyrinth, maybe.
Ugh.
Okay, shut up.
But no, you know, Legend for me was... It's a mess of a movie. It's something that, you know, right from the beginning, it feels so scattershot. It's just been edited to death. And what's funny about it is, in spite of all of that, every time I put it on, it still never fails to entertain me. It's such a captivatingly gorgeous movie to look at. Every single shot in that movie is a work of art. You know, it is absolutely gorgeous. I'd almost say it's probably the darkest looking of Ridley's movies when you get into the caves and stuff. Like, everything is just so black and so bleak and terrible looking, you know, like terrifying. But it's got this surreal feeling to it that I really, really like. Like, it's just this surreality that goes through the whole film that I really enjoy. But then, of course, there's the script, which is just terrible, you know, absolutely, like, pointless, meandering, you know, essentially good versus evil.
I want to punch
William Hjortsberg.
No, not him.
The crooked movie executive with the cigarette.
Princess.
Yeah.
You can't have the
Satan fuck the princess. That is by far the
funniest. I've read the original script for Legend, and it's, despite the fact that the final scene is that he had written is what my dreams look like. Tom Cruise riding a unicorn over a rainbow bridge and just ramming the unicorn horn through the Lord of Darkness's chest, which would have been the single most expensive and greatest scene in movie history. That script is fucking terrible.
It's not like
it really is.
I demand Tom Cruise riding a unicorn across a rainbow bridge.
The screenplay as written is not a Ridley Scott film. It really isn't.
No,
it's what ended up, what we got was essentially, yeah, I think Ridley's first and last attempt at fantasy. And what's really even more curious about it is people kind of blame Blade Runner's failure on Legend and say, you know, he was interfered with and yada, yada, yada. But that's actually converse. That's not true at all. Ever since Blade Runner, every single movie that Scott has done, having director's cut rights was one of the things he intentionally built into his contracts after the experience he had making Blade Runner. However,
and why does he wait 20 fucking years to release that director's cut?
That wasn't a director's cut. That was the international cut. That was the version that was released overseas in 86. It's not a new cut. It's an old cut. The thing with Legend is, I think after Blade Runner's failure and then abysmal test screenings, I just think his confidence was shattered. I think that, you know, he was still, you know, people forget, he was still a relatively new director. I mean, yeah, he had The Duelists, which, you know, did well at Cannes, and he had Alien, but Blade Runner was a flop. You know, Blade Runner didn't do anything, and then we get Legend, you know, so it was, you know, I think maybe he was still kind of finding his feet as a director of motion pictures, and I think maybe he was having a little bit of that, you know, that the jitters. I think he was genuinely nervous about his success. You know, I think it was mainly like, okay, I've had my first big colossal flop. That's it. One more and I'm done. And
I got to play ball on this one.
Yeah. When Legend kind of came around, when the test screenings hit, and you know, he was saying that the test screened it, I think, in San Francisco, and it was in like an art house crowd and everybody was high as a kite and whatever else, you know, it didn't test well. And of course it didn't test well. It wasn't a movie.
Now, if they'd had Tom Cruise and the unicorn, the rainbow bridge, and that audience, yeah. Fucking great, well, opening in movie history.
I was thinking more, it wasn't by a director whose name they couldn't pronounce, and it wasn't about thieves on a voyage of sexual discovery in Paris in the 1960s. Then it would have been successful, you know, but like it was just, I think it was just kind of the stars aligned and Ridley's confidence was just so shaky that he said, you know, well, maybe we'll try this, maybe we'll try that. And I think what happened with Legend was it just kind of got butchered in editing in the hopes of salvaging something that was, you know, marketable and accessible. And I think that kind of blew up in his face a little bit. So I kind of blame Ridley entirely for Legend. But it's still a goddamn beautiful
movie. Take that, Ridley Scott.
It's still a beautiful movie to look at. It's still
like, there's a great anecdote that Ridley Scott relates in his commentary on Legend, talking about, I believe David Bennett played Gump.
Yeah.
And they ended up dubbing him.
Yeah.
Because one of the producers, he's from Switzerland, and I believe a German speaker originally, and so he had a you know, German Swiss accent. And one of the producers says, we can't have a fucking Nazi as a fairy in this movie or whatever.
What's even funnier is that Gump goes on to be voiced by the same actress who played Blix.
Yeah.
Blix,
the leader of the goblins. And she doesn't make any attempt to hide that.
No.
Yeah.
Blix and Gump sound exactly the same.
A mortal laid hands on a unicorn.
And what happens to Blix in that movie? She just disappears.
I think,
you know, Meg Muckle
into the ADR studio. That's where she disappeared to.
She had lines to dub. Jeez.
No, sorry, Tom. You can't cut Alice's head off today. She's got lines to dub.
There's so much a Legend that I still really enjoy. And I guess, you know, that's the point of our bad. Our bad is, you know, movies we like but are flawed. And I can still sit down and watch the hell out of Legend, but, you know, when I do, half the movie I'm shaking my head.
Yeah. But I have to say, I don't know what they were thinking. You know, they come up at the end, you know, they come up with this idea to get light reflected down this big tunnel. And, you know, this should be the climax of the movie, and they have Billy, or I don't know if it's Billy Barty or one of the others, but, you know, climbing up this thing slowly and then falling asleep. And it's like, you literally put a character to sleep and let us watch him sleep when it should be the most high energy part of the movie.
Okay.
Oh, it's so terrible.
Gabriel, hit us with your bad.
My bad is, well, talking about fantasy, it's G.I. Jane. I mean, it's so obviously, like, mandated picture with, like, oh, we're going to prove that, like, women can do the army. But, hey, we don't want an actual woman to direct the film. Like, we'll get this guy. I mean, Ridley Scott, he did Alien, right? And he did Thelma and Louise. He must be some kind of feminist. So...
I am still convinced Scott was actually sitting on Ridley's shoulder while he was directing that film.
Not a word of a lie. When I was young and stupid, I actually thought Ridley Scott was a woman.
You know,
that's
Andrew,
because that's because you thought that the director of Alien was actually Ripley.
You're not far from the truth, Andrew, with your comment, actually.
Yeah.
Ridley had been, you know, had kind of fallen out of grace in Hollywood, and Tony was tearing up the joint. Tony was the original director for G.I. Jane, and he passed on it to go, I think it was to do Crimson Tide, and when he passed it over, like, basically...
And he lent Ridley his red hat.
He went to the studio and said, look, he went to his exec, because I think they were both Touchstone or Hollywood Pictures. They were both Disney anyway, and he wanted to choose Crimson Tide because of Simpson and Bruckheimer.
It was Enemy of the State.
Because it was actually a decent script.
Yeah, well, no,
he had already finished Crimson Tide. He wanted to move on to do Enemy of the State.
Enemy of the State, yeah. And what it was basically is he went to the executive and said, look, how about I bring my brother in to shoot G.I. Jane? You know, I'd rather move on to this other movie. So Tony essentially, you know, he essentially built it and developed it and then Ridley directed. Ridley just basically showed up on day one and said action kind of thing.
But the hat was part of the deal.
One of the big failings of G.I. Jane is, of course, the casting of Demi Moore. She looks good and she can do all those push-ups and stuff, but she brings nothing. I mean, we're supposed to have this strong female character, but she's a blank. There's no personality there.
Suck my dick, sir.
That's about it. That's the extent of her personality.
Yeah, like, guys, we're 11 years past Private Vasquez, right? we've seen this scenario, and it is terrifying. But you need to bring in more than a piece of balsa wood to play it.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
Being up against an actor as awesome as Viggo Mortensen doesn't help. Viggo's really great in the role. I mean, he plays
amazing.
He plays like a total asshole, but at the same time, you see that he cares for his troops and, like, he's being mostly fair to everyone. You know, he treats everyone mostly.
He's doing his job. Watch out doesn't deserve to be a Navy SEAL.
Yeah. And right? my thing with, like, what I get to with G.I. Jane, and again, we get back to that Ridley Scott touch. The first two-thirds of that movie, to me, are convincing. Like, to me, I like Demi in the movie. I think she does a great job with it. But, I mean, you get, like, the thing with me and Demi Moore in that film is you are talking about an enlisted soldier. You're talking about someone who went through boot camp and all of this kind of stuff. And the first thing they drain out of a soldier in boot camp, especially in the early 90s, was personality.
But still, the guys like Cortez has more personality than she does.
Yeah,
and
that is definitely the Hollywood trickery at work there for sure. But I thought she did a fine job with it, and I thought, like, the first two thirds of the movie, it really felt, you know, like I equated to it could have been up there with Thelma and Louise in my book. It really could have been a great film, but then that final act kicks in, man.
That's what really kills it.
Yeah,
I mean. Oh, she plays on the beach with some women in a bikini, and suddenly she's a lesbian. I mean, like,
thing is, man,
there's no pictures of her, like, eating carpet or anything. She's just like.
Wow.
No, guys, it's awesome. I am no longer the one who spoke in the most horrible words on this podcast.
But no, I mean, even that aspect, what bugs me...
I'm going to message Mitch right now.
She gets drummed out. They trump up this thing, and they drum her out. Okay, fine. And you got, you know, the the senator, the female senator or whatever it is who's trying to get it all pushed through. And you get the scene with the two of them and stuff. And all of that's fine and dandy. But she's out. She's gone. She has failed to become a Navy SEAL. And then all of a sudden, Master Chief went on a mission in Afghanistan and was kidnapped. Only you can save him, Demi Moore. It's like, where the fuck did this come from?
Q Crimson.
We have no other special forces.
One thing I give it to his credit is that scene where she's taking in her shower and the Master Chief comes in and like there's like he just talks to her as if she's another soldier.
Yeah, I like.
And like, may I get dressed, please, sir?
Yeah. I enjoy G.I. Jane. I mean,
it's a pretty good movie, like you said, except for the third act and the fact that it's obviously propaganda.
Oh, well, yeah. Yeah, for sure.
There's so much to this movie that bothered me.
And also, I was going to say that it probably would have been better if Bigelow had directed it.
Are we on?
Anne Bancroft is terrible in this.
Yes, she is.
I'm just putting that out there.
Thank you. The trailer, I didn't want to see any more of the movie because of her. The I never thought you'd do so damn well.
Yeah.
Anne Bancroft is played by Tommy Lee Jones.
and that guy who plays her husband, he's just like to quote Andrew, the most charismatic piece of Melba toast.
Yeah, but like, I shouldn't have said Tommy Lee Jones. I just thought of something. It's like she's channeling Max Cady. The whole like, just picture that.
Yeah, counselor.
Yeah, you can see her smoking the cigar.
They're great at that age, ain't they?
It's one of those movies. Yeah. I know, like, when it came out, there was actually a pretty big stink, like a pretty big deal kicked up over it and stuff too. It was.
Oh, I remember there was a ton of hype for it.
Yeah,
and it was like, oh, Demi Moore, she's got a shaved head. Like,
well, not even saw that. Not
forgotten
even saw
Alien 3. Mean,
this movie was next in line of the whole Bruckheimer Simpson train that was rolling along. I mean, these guys hadn't produced a flop since Bad Boys, right?
Yeah. And G.I. Jane did open huge as well. I mean, it opened really huge. It had a really successful run.
Made back twice its budget.
Yep.
By the look of things, or just about twice its budget. Just one of those things that was forgotten in the 90s.
He's also terrible in this movie.
Who's that?
Scott Wilson. He's from Atlanta, and I think he's still putting on a southern accent.
And I mean, all in all, it's not an especially memorable movie.
Holy shit, Jesus was in it.
Yep.
Yeah, Jim Caviezel or whatever.
And Morris Chestnut plays a character named McCool.
I love that.
That is fucking amazing.
Okay, we've got Cortez. Pyro, Flea, Wickwire, McCool, C.O. Salem, like
Instructor Max Pyro. What the fuck, David Tui? That better be the name of one of the bounty hunters chasing Riddick in the new movie.
David Tui is the worst person in the world.
Hey.
No, we're not going down that road.
All right.
Move on to the ugly so I can. So Andrew and I can maintain friendship.
G.I. Jane.
Okay, here we go. Ugly. John, you start.
A bit of a weird choice for me.
Uh-oh.
I went with someone to watch over me.
Oh, okay. That's not so weird.
Now, no, but my reasoning on it is weird. Do you remember that late 80s serial killer movie where Judd Nelson was the psycho police academy washout who was killing random folks out of the phone book and trying to embarrass the cops using his police training?
No.
Tyler Perry.
Yeah, no, like, it had this really awesome home video cover of John Bender's fucking crazy eyes staring out from the hole his knife had just sliced through the pages of a phone book. Up until last week, I was convinced that was someone to watch over me. apparently that's completely like fucking unrelated movie directed by the guy who directed Maniac Cop and
William Lustig.
Yeah, when you look at a director like Ridley Scott, having a movie go absolutely forgotten is what it takes to make it my ugly.
Yeah.
You know, at least Legends got that fucking special edition DVD. Who gives a shit about someone to watch over?
Tom Berenger, maybe?
I had to watch this movie on fucking YouTube. The director of Gladiator, and I had to look up a movie on YouTube.
What's really funny about it is the DVD is actually pretty bitchin'.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm not going to say it was a terrible movie, you know. I like Tom Berenger enough, and it was just like I was saying earlier about Black Rain. You know, Black Rain, someone to watch a movie is a movie Black Rain would have left in its wake.
Yeah.
You know, it's just forgettable. It doesn't feel like a Ridley Scott movie. And it's,
I don't care how young Mimi Rogers is, she is a soccer mom.
He still looks like my mom.
And after this and Medicine Man, Lauren Bracco is now on my hate list.
Aww. She's so awesome in The Sopranos.
And in Goodfellas, but that's about it, I think.
And I mean, I'm going to say something now. I'm just going to get it out there. I don't think it's a horrible movie because I really don't think Ridley Scott has made a movie that's just absolute dog shit.
No.
He hasn't done it, in my opinion. But Someone to Watch Over Me, just it's the redheaded stepchild from the movie industry's redheaded stepchild, right? It's just, you see what I did there.
I see
what and yeah, I went into it thinking it was going to be like some forgotten, like long lost forgotten secret, like it was going to be, we're talking Super Mario Brothers bad. But no, it's just it was just a late 80s cop movie that you could have told me was directed by John Badham or Roger Donaldson, and I would have believed you.
Yeah.
Well, there's a few sequences I like in the apartment, like when the killer's inside or when Lauren Bracco thinks she's hearing a stalker. That feel Ridley-ish, but it's only like two 5 minutes out of a 2 hour movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. You like what I did with Relentless, though, right? I when I was writing that, I was thinking I was either going to do it with that or Jagged Edge, but Relentless was funnier.
My ugly, I also picked Someone to Watch Over Me, and pretty much for the same reason as John. Like, me with Ridley Scott is kind of like Andrew with Cronenberg. You know, Ridley Scott is my favorite director. I make no bones about it. I'm a big fanboy. And the reason for it is because I enjoy his movies so much. I mean, if Ridley Scott made movies I didn't enjoy, he wouldn't be my favorite director. You know, I don't actively seek out to love his movies because his name is attached to them. However, I will generally take a look at something if his name is attached to it. You know, like, I will consider it before anything else. But my thing with Someone to Watch Over Me is it does not feel like a Ridley Scott film. You know, it doesn't have the feel that there was a whole lot of thought or a whole lot of development put into it. Like, it doesn't feel like the script was pondered over or the production was especially well designed or executed. It just feels like a by the numbers, you know, one of those 80s steamy sex thrillers, you know, like Body Heat and Fatal Attraction and all of this stuff, you know. It just,
which is probably exactly what he was looking for after Legend and Blade Runner.
Yeah,
it's not as good as either of those plays.
Yeah, and I think that's what it is. I think just after the failure of Legend and Blade Runner, I think he just took a paycheck and cashed it, you know. And that's the sad thing about Someone to Watch Over Me. For me, it's a paycheck film. It feels like a paycheck film. While Black Rain, like,
well, those fine hunt. Cigars don't pay for themselves.
Yeah, no, and I mean, I know Black Rain was a paycheck film as well. Black Rain was something he took for a paycheck, but Black Rain had his fingers all over it. You know, like, it really felt like a Ridley Scott film, more so than probably 80% of his output in that particular era. But Someone to Watch Over Me just does not feel like a Ridley Scott flick. I mean, it works. It's a movie that works. It's not a terrible film. It's completely unassumed, you know? And the final...
You remember our Tony Scott episode when we spoke about Revenge?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Someone to Watch Over Me is Ridley's Revenge, right?
I guess it could be. I could see
that. Except I take that as an insult to Revenge.
But no, it's... So,
shut up, John.
And it's not a complete... Like, it's not a worthless movie. It's not a waste of time. There's some good stuff in there. Behringer's excellent in it. Andreas Katsoulis is excellent in it. The final act is actually really good. You know, when it all starts to come together, it's actually a pretty good flick. It's just, it's so meandering for that first, you know, 45 minutes or so. Like, oh, does he love his wife? Does he love this witness that he's protecting? Oh, does he love his wife? Oh, back and forth, back and forth. It's like, you got to get off this case. You got to stop seeing her. It's like, oh, but it's my job. It's my duty. And then I'm going to go to her apartment and have mad monkey sex with her. You know, like, it's just, it's one of those things where I keep feeling, and I hate to say this because I love him as an actor, I keep feeling that Michael Douglas should have been playing the Tom Berenger character.
And seriously, between Bracco and Rogers, the choice is obvious.
Yeah, you know. It's just, and I mean, I think that was partially kind of intentional as well, though. That was definitely intentionally done in casting. But no, it's just, it's one of those movies that, you know, it's there.
Oh, and also The guy who plays the serial killer in this movie,
Andreas Katsoulis,
creepiest mannequin I've ever seen. Is this the same guy who played the one-armed man in The Fugitive?
It is, yeah. It is.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, you know, it's a movie that it works, but it just, it in Ridley's body of work, it fades completely into nothing.
And it's also as Gorbach playing the same character he always plays.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's totally Lumiere in this.
How about you, Gabriel? What's your ugly?
Well, I tipped my hand earlier, and it has to be Legend for me.
Okay.
Move on. Fuck you, Montreal.
I mean, you guys pretty much explained what's wrong about it. And for me, the beauty doesn't even save... for me, I mean, it's a beautiful... shell. It's like, you know, one of those glass bubbles with like a house inside that you turn around and there's snow falling. That's it. You know, it's something that you can see at your aunt's place, you know, like a sculpture that's totally useless, but is
Gabriel.
But even a snow globe can be used to dispatch an enemy. I don't think you can do that with Legend.
You compared Legend to Labyrinth, and love Jim Henson.
You remind me of the Babe.
You know, I would give anything to have been able to give Jim Henson a hug before he died. But you're also comparing Jim Henson to the director of Blade Runner.
Hey, it's true, but I don't know. I really, really enjoy Labyrinth. I think it's a great movie, but I mean, that's a discussion for another time, I guess.
Yeah.
I really liked Legend when I was a kid, and I tried to watch it with my brothers just to show them this movie, and we all pretty much hated it. It's too and too confusing. There's nothing to hang except for the beauty. I mean, that's it. To me, it's just a beautiful empty shell, and that's what it stops there.
And that's a totally fair critique.
Yeah, that's fair criticism.
Let us end where we began. Mr. Forbes.
You know, I'm tempted to cheat here and actually put Legend in as my ugly as well. Because there really isn't a movie
that
John has done that is so complete nonsensical.
Admit that you hate...
What?
Damn this baby seal powered internet we have in Canada.
Call Bordeaux fast.
I said, you coward, admit that you hate Thelma and Louise, that you hate women right now.
Well, you know, to be fair, I feel that in the design process, the vagina should have been put on the chest. As we covered in the Cronenberg episode. But I like women. John, stop. Sound like a horrible misogynist. Legend is the biggest mess. Okay, you know what? I think the only way I could really deal with Ugly, because, Steve, you're pretty much right. I mean, Ridley Scott hasn't done anything that is just entirely awful.
No.
Because it's always at least got the aesthetic sheen over it.
I'd agree. I mean,
so what I kind of have to do is I'm going to jump around, and I'm going to talk about a few things from his weaker movies that really irritate me.
Oh, God.
basically, the everything but the visuals in Legend, a lot of G.I. Jane, primarily the fact that it is just it's filled with terrible acting and feels less like a Ridley movie than a Tony movie, but also to touch on White Squall. And
don't you diss White Squall.
Okay, we will have you, Andrew Forbes.
I have to be fair, I'll be honest, I didn't watch all of White Squall, so I'm not making a judgment on the film as a whole.
Oh.
The best part.
But White Squall, the entire first was like the most beautiful, and Jeff Bridges was amazing, but it was like every single coming of age / goes to war movie I've ever seen in my life.
That's why you need to watch the whole thing.
That's the kind of movie that it is.
Yes.
Boys become men, and it's the asterisk by the storm.
I mean, I just, it was like every time I was just like counting off the beats, I was like, as soon as they said, we're expected to host a cruise for a group of like Norwegians or whatever, I was like, they're all going to be schoolgirls. Oh my God, they were all schoolgirls. Let's have a dance. Oh, and then you have the English teacher who's every single one of his lines is a Shakespearean quote. Like, honestly, gag me with a Glock.
Oh, come on. You're just too jaded.
I
was just pointing out the stuff that irritated me. As I said, there was a lot. There was also a lot in there. It's awesome.
Yeah, well, in the second half of that movie, when shit goes sideways and it turns on his ear, and just going back and thinking about it, you come to realize how, despite any acclaim he gets, Jeff Bridges is one of the most undeservedly uncelebrated actors in the world.
Yeah, I agree. And
right? The guy is fucking amazing, and the second half of White Squall is proof in the pudding of that fact.
Yeah, I just...
I got it lined up to watch right after we finish this, but unfortunately, you know, linear chronology, I just had to come and record this thing, so...
My whole thing with White Squall and with most of Ridley's movies is it sucks me in, man. It's everything is so well realized and so, you know, so fully, like, so well executed, so fully designed that I was there. I was on the boat, you know, I was on the boat with these guys, and it didn't matter to me that they were stock characters or they were, you know, boys own cliches, because I was there. I was on deck with them, and you know, the cliches come from somewhere. Cliches are generated from somewhere. It, you know, yeah, okay, fine, the script was genetically engineered to be appealing to the mainstream, but there's nothing wrong with that, especially where White Squall is concerned. Like, you know, yes, it is an appealing film, but it's, you know, I know we talked about Jack London a few episodes ago, you know, and it's that kind of thing. You know, Jack London wrote pulpy boys' own wilderness adventure stories, but they were awesome because they were pulpy boys' own wilderness adventure stories.
But all of these things that I've seen a million times have never appealed to me.
Well, and I guess,
even the first time, like, I just find them facile. So as much as I saw to that point, I was certainly not hooked by White Squall. I do want to know, though, why has Jeff Rona not been celebrated for the musical genius that he is?
I don't know.
Sarcasm!
Any final thoughts on the early bit of Mr. Ridley Scott's career?
Well, I think, like, after as we said, after Blade Runner flop, basically, he put himself back in question and was trying to find himself again through most of that time, you know, while still making movies and, you know, doing stuff that appealed to him somewhat. He was still trying to find out, oh, where am I going now as a filmmaker after this thing that I loved failed? You can see very much a director in search, you know, of what defines him.
Mm-hmm. He was definitely more than a bit lost in the mid 80s, and then for a little while in the mid 90s there. I don't think, you know, I don't think he had a strong grasp of what was going to be marketable, and I don't think audiences quite knew how to react to the movies he was making. So, yeah.
How about you, John?
I'm just glad that we settled the Black Rain issue.
How about you, John?
We're talking about, this is me speaking as an artist, we're talking about a director who managed to make miles and miles and miles and miles of telephone poles along a desert highway leading to a blue sky look like the most visually exciting thing in the world. I wanted to go on vacation to fucking Arizona after seeing Thelma Louise. This is a man who, it's just as well to say, you know, when he's making a movie, he might as well be painting on canvas. Everything is just so, you know, he makes worlds, right?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, I like to quote, it's a really awesome Gary Oldman quote. When you come out of the movies, you should come out feeling like you got a rocket strapped to your ass. And that's how Ridley Scott movies generally make me feel.
I think you're supposed to shit yourself. Because I've been doing it wrong.
Legend made me shit myself in a bad way.
Oh.
I'm sorry. What's the good way?
I'll sum it up. You know, Ridley Scott, as I said earlier, he is my favorite director. He is someone whose work I can really appreciate. I mean, I come from a design background. I think you do too as well, Andrew, don't you?
Yep.
So when I look at Scott's movies...
Hey,
move along.
What am I then?
And John, yes, Mercer. Sorry, I'm sorry.
So I'm the only one not gifted.
I only own a goddamn print shop.
Jesus. But what I see when I sit down and I look at a Ridley Scott movie, I see, you know, the principles of visual design and graphic design put to work. I see that, like his mastery over frame, his mastery over how the eye moves, how the eye takes in a scene. He makes it so memorable. He makes it really kind of stand out in your mind. He is painterly, you know. He really creates striking visuals, and it's not just in production design, it's not just in lighting, it's not just in smog, it's in how he frames a shot, you know. It really is. The guy really does have, I think it might have been Anthony Hopkins who said it, he was born with a golden eye, and he really, really does have that. Just that visual panache.
Golden eye.
He does have that real visual sense. But on top of that, he's got a little bit of an extra dimension to most of his movies. Like, he doesn't just take a screenplay, hire a crew, and go shoot it. You know, he sits down and he dismantles a screenplay and rebuilds it. And he always kind of builds these extra little questions, these little ambiguities. And it's not ambitious. You know, it's not ambitious. It's not, you know, complete mind screws or anything like you'd expect from someone like Cronenberg or David Lynch or even Kubrick in his prime. You know, it's more, he tries to keep his films accessible, but at the same time he tries to do more than just entertain. He tries to kind of raise questions, raise awareness about issues. You know, I think what Ridley really wants someone to do when they walk out of one of his movies is not just say that was a damn good time at the movies, but he wants people to think about him. He wants people to kind of ask questions and kind of come to their own conclusions about certain things. He's not trying to preach. He's trying to teach.
Hmm.
That's how I really feel
I
about
think him. One of the most compelling questions he has raised is, why Scott Wolf? Why are you alive?
And that's another thing. I mean, we talked a lot about Blade Runner, Alien, you know, and Legend, which are kind of that is really the trifecta. That are, those are really the three like most well known of his early works. But I gotta give quick shout outs to The Duelists, which is just an amazing, amazing little picture, man. Amazing work. And for a first film, so assured and so just beautifully filmed, gorgeous, gorgeous movie. Thelma and Louise is another fantastic flick. You know, like it still deserves all the accolades that it got. Yeah, it was a little bit, you know, girl empowered, which was all the rage at the time and stuff. But it's still a great movie. And Sarandon,
and it doesn't really feel like an issue movie like G.I. Jane does.
No, exactly. It's not trying to push any agenda or anything. You know, it's just Susan Sarandon and Gina Davis. And Harvey Keitel also, you know, giving great performances in a beautifully shot little movie. 1492, solid little flick, but White Squall, I don't think gets any credit, and I think it deserves.
1492, Michael Wincott alert.
Yeah, Michael Wincott alert. We still don't have any Kim Coates sightings, but we've got a Michael Wincott sighting.
Kim Coates!
But it's, you know, it's he's got, even in his early body of work, which is something that a lot of people really overlook, there's a lot of little gems in there. There's a lot of really great little pictures in there, man.
Mm-hmm. Well,
and then there's someone to watch over me.
And then there is someone to watch over me. And Legend. On that note, we will call it. I hope you guys come back and join us next week when we discuss the later Ridley Scott era, Ridley Scott Part 2. I'm sure it's going to be fun.
It will be entirely consensus. There will be no contentious arguments.
Of course there won't be. Until next time, farewell.